Session number 3166.
Air Vice Marshal Capel, Reel 4. You returned from India in 1928, and you then went for the first of two periods you spent at the School of Army Corporation at Old Sarum. This first time you were there from 1929 to 1930. You were the senior administrative officer. What did the School of Army Corporation at Old Sarum consist of?
Well, we had the school, to which was attached a squadron of 12 aircraft, and in addition we had number 16 squadron, who were the Army Cooperation Squadron for the Southern Command, primarily. And they were with us for administration only, really, and ran their own show. As far as the school was concerned, the commandant at Old Sarum was the chief officer of the school, the head of the school.
What planes were you equipped with at that time?
At that time, we had Bristol fighters, and 16 Squadron had the same.
You've been dealing with those in India, of
and
course.
And the whole time in India, yes.
What were your duties as senior administrative officer in that first period?
Well, just the general administration of the station, including the keeping of elementary accounts, such as the sergeant's mess, PSI, so on. And I was instructed in the keeping of accounts by the station accountant officer, and I found that extremely useful for the rest of my life, to be able to keep quite simple accounts in a reasonable way. And apart from that, it was just, running the administrative side. There was nothing particular. We also had a small pig farm, which also came under me, and we used to buy and sell in the Salisbury market and breed from our sows, and made a bit of money for the PSI, which I think was probably slightly illegal, but had been on for some time and nobody queried it. One airman was detailed as Pigman.
What did the actual courses at Old Sarum in Army Corporation, how many were there in a year, and what kind of work did went on at Old Sarum in the courses?
Well, if I remember, there were three courses a year. They were for RAF pilots, and also we had several seconded army officers, seconded for 4 years, who also came. They were treated exactly the same as the RAF pilots and went through the same course. There was no difference for them. And in between those courses, there were two other courses. One was for signal officers of both Army and Air Force, who came for, as far as I remember, a week's course. And then also there was the senior officers course, which consisted of quite high up Army officers and some Air Force, who came for a week also and did fairly high-powered instruction, which was largely dealt with by outside lecturers who were appointed. The school was not called upon really to do most of the instruction.
Did you find that these two groups, the people from the Army and the people from the Air Force who came to Old Sarum, first of all, as regards the actual work, had the Army people volunteered to do this particular course, and were they as enthusiastic about the value of the course and about the value of air power as the RAF people?
Well, I think in both cases they were very interested, yes, especially the senior Army officers, who always gave the impression that they were very keen on this course.
What sort of people came to the lecture, to the senior officers' course?
Well, as far as I remember, they were pretty senior Air Force officers from the commands and from the Air Ministry.
Was the course actually related to Army Corporation, or was it a more general course, the senior Army?
Oh, no, it was primarily related to Army Corporation, but of course a certain amount of general stuff was dealt with.
Yes. What kind of contact did you actually have with the army when you were? Did the school actually have with the army while you were at Old Sarum? Did you participate, for instance, with the army in joint manoeuvres?
Oh yes, not the school. 16 Squadron did from the aerodrome, but the school cooperated largely with the other army schools round the plain, and principally the School of Artillery at Lark Hill and the Small Arms School at Netheravon.
What sort of things did the school do in cooperation with those other establishments? What were the different elements in army cooperation work that were particularly concentrated on in the actual work of the school?
Well, I think the I think it was largely lectures on both sides, and I can't remember whether the school did cooperation with Lark Hill or whether it was 16 Squadron, but I think it was the school.
You actually returned to Old Sarum then for a second period in 1936 to 1938 when you were the commandant of the school. From your more overall view of what was going on in the school at that time, what developments had there been by the second half of the 1930s in army cooperation work?
Well, not really very much. We were carrying on very much on the same sort of lines. And I do remember there was quite a question going on as to how vulnerable army cooperation aircraft would be when spotting for artillery with the modern developments of fighters, especially with relation to the Autogyro, of which we'd just got our first one. The general opinion, both of ourselves and the gunners, was that unless you had a very high degree of air superiority, which was unlikely in the early stages of any foreseeable war, slow aircraft carrying out artillery cooperation would not have much chance of survival if the enemy made a dead set at them.
Tell me a bit more about this, the Autogyro. How many of those did you actually have at Old Sarum?
My recollection is that up to the time when I left, we only had one. It was flown by Squadron Leader Hayworth Booth, and he was carrying out such experiments as we were able to do in takeoffs and landings in small confined spaces, and assessing its value for artillery cooperation.
What did you feel particularly about the? Did you feel that the Autogyro actually was likely to be of any value in the foreseeable future?
Well, if it could possibly live in the air, it was very valuable because, of course, it could almost land at a battery position and wouldn't be dependent on going back to an aerodrome each time it wanted to land. In that way, it would have been very valuable. But the question was whether it could possibly live in the air, except in cases of practically air supremacy.
Did you actually have an opportunity to fly it yourself?
I didn't actually fly it myself, but I went up in it with Hayworth Booth.
Was that an enjoyable experience, or was it rather
very,
a prototype?
Very interesting. It was a new experience altogether. By that time, we were equipped with the AUDAX, which was the heart version of the Army Corporation aircraft, And we were also beginning to get lysambas.
And were they a great improvement on anything that you'd had up to then?
Well, the Audax, of course, was much faster than the Bristol, and the Lysander had wonderful view downwards. But it was rather a blind aircraft from the point of view of defending itself against enemy fighters, and was really had no special speed to compensate for its rather blind view other than down. I flew the Lysander several times. It was a nice aircraft to fly, but it was quite obvious that it was would have been difficult to defend against air attack.
What kind of contact did you personally have with the army during that period? Did you participate in army manoeuvres at all, either during the first period or during the second?
16 Squadron did the most of the army cooperation on the plane during manoeuvres, but I was called upon to personally almost entirely as umpire.
What sort of thing did working as an umpire involve?
Well, you had to get about as best you can during the operations and try and decide whether air attacks had caused, likely to have caused either damage or some disruption in the plan, and give a ruling.
Did you tend to be rather biased in favour of the effectiveness of air actions?
I hope I was reasonable. You had to, the army on the ground had to be more or less to accept your ruling, which as far as I remember they usually did, as long as you weren't too extravagant.
Was there actually any way of, was this all done with, presumably with dummy ammunition? Was there actually any way of establishing whether hits had been scored? Or
well, we had flower bombs, which burst and gave a white mark where they'd hit, of course, but couldn't assimilate the damage that might have been done by an explosion. You had to assess. That's what you had to assess.
What sort of things did the air, were the air particularly set on to attack in these manoeuvres?
Any formed body of troops, either a battery on the move or battalion on the move and that sort of thing.
Were communications also attacked at all, in theory? I'm thinking of rail commute. Were any attacks, were attacks on, say, railways or bridges or anything like that practiced at all?
My recollection, no.
So you mentioned slightly a bit earlier about your doubts about the army cooperation work. Did you come to the conclusion really that a lot of what was you were training for was not in fact a viable proposition against an enemy equipped with modern planes as opposed to tribesmen in India?
I think very little of what we did proved to have any real application in the start of the Second War after the and during the May Blitz.
Do you feel that was simply because of the kind of planes that you were equipped with at the time, the Audax and Lysander, or could more have been made of those planes with a different way of approaching things?
Of course, speaking with with hindsight, as the Army Corps operation developed in the desert later, there were even Hurricane bombers became the sort of Army Corps operation aircraft, and close support was just as important or more important than observation, reconnaissance, and so on.
But at Old Sarum, there was no practice in close support work. It was rather just cooperation work.
It was very much reconnaissance and artillery observation.
In 1938, at the time of Munich, for instance, when you were commandant there, what kind of preparations were made at Old Sarum in case war actually broke out at that time?
Well, we didn't do more than disperse the aircraft by flights around the aerodrome and pig them out, dispersed as possible. But apart from that, we didn't do anything particular. There being no, far as we knew, no arrangements for a force going overseas to the continent. And even if there had been, the school would presumably not have gone. We were not a unit, not an active service unit.
And let's talk now then about your two periods at the Staff College at Camberley, the Army Staff College, first as a student, 1931 to 1932, and then as the RAF instructor in 1935 to 1936. In the first period, when you were a student, what was the particular aim of sending you on that course to the Army Staff College?
Well, all the three staff colleges had representatives of the other services. We had two RAF and two Navy on the course at Camberley, and we took the ordinary part that the Army student took. We formed part of syndicates. We were given the same work as them. But of course, in ordinary conversation, one was often asked questions about Air Force matters. And we had an Air Force instructor on the directing staff. So as a student, we were not called upon to give lectures or anything, because that was done by the DS member. Apart from that, we just pretended we were soldiers and did our best to take our part in all the exercises.
Who was the RAF instructor when you went there as a student?
Jack Slessor.
What kind of was that the first time you'd come across Sir John Slessor? What kind of impression did he make on you at that time?
I knew him before. Can't quite remember particularly where, but of course, I'd met his father at Oxford when I was at the beginning of the First War, when I was going into the army through Oxford. But he, all the time I was up at Oxford, he was a boy at Haileybury. So I never actually met him, although I used to go out to tea with his parents.
What sort of impression did he make?
He was a first-class instructor, I would have said. And he was very acceptable to the army. I think he got on very well with the other DS, and he was certainly a very able instructor.
When you went back to the Staff College for the second time in 1935, you were actually doing the job that Sir John Sless had been doing when you went there as a student. You were the RAF instructor on the directing staff. What were your particular responsibilities as the representative of the RAF on the directing staff?
Well, of course, I had to give the RAF lectures. I took over from Jack Stresser, actually, he left me some very valuable papers on which I built my own instruction during the next 2 years.
What subjects did you have to instruct on at the staff college?
Well, I mean, apart from particular Air Force lectures, one had to take syndicates, exactly the same as the Army DS did, which was a bit difficult at times because although one had what was called the DS solution to go by, you had to judge whether some other solution was either good or better or ridiculous. And there you had to keep your wits about you, judge as best you could.
Can you remember any of the particular kinds of problems that you lectured on or dealt with in syndicates? Were these, for instance, were these problems, was it looking backwards to the First World War, to actual historical campaigns, the use of the RAF, or did you also devise theoretical ideas for future campaigns?
Well, there were sort of vague attention was given to the possibility of armoured warfare, but in a very, very small way. They didn't really, I don't think, ever envisage large armoured forces. One little interesting sidelight, we were having a DS conference on how to fit in 2 days, one indoor, one outdoor, with an armoured element, which was to be fitted on to an existing indoor and outdoor exercise. And the problem arose, when could the 2 days be arranged? And after a lot of discussion, including such things as whether the farmer's cricket match or Ascot could be interfered with, the conclusion was reached that it was not possible to do it that summer and would have to be built into the next year's, some exercise next year. And I remember Chink Dorman Smith, who was one of the DS, got up and said, I wonder how much longer the British Army will be able to retain its amateur status, which I think was a fair comment at that time, this being something like 1938.
From all your contact with the Army between the wars, how do you think the Army compared with the RAF in relation to its preparedness for war? Would the RAF have not deserved the title amateur in the way that possibly the Army did?
That's rather hard to say. You've got to remember that from 1930 onwards, until Hitler began to get rampant, there was real economy. Everybody was being cut down as much as possible. But I think the Air Force were possibly planning further ahead to the days of the four-engine bomber and looking to how that might be used effectively. Whereas my impression was that the Army were very much content to go along more or less studying the lessons of the First War still. Another thing was we were often shown at Camberley the latest either signal lorry or armoured personnel carrier or something, and they used to turn up in ones or twos, and that was all there was, and they never seemed to be able to decide whether that was good enough to go into production or not. And the net result was that practically nothing went into production, nothing modern. That was the impression I got.
What did you find were the main points which you needed to get across to the Army people about the uses of air power?
Well, first of all, that there's no good dividing it up into penny packets. The idea of each battalion or each brigade even having a call on one or two aircraft was just not on. And the other thing was to try and put over some idea of the probable accuracy of bombing. I think they had an exaggerated idea that if an aircraft went up with a bomb, the bomb would hit the target. They didn't think the same thing about artillery. And one had to really plug, I think, the limitations of bombing at that time.
Did you cross swords with the army members of the directing staff about matters like that?
No, I think they very much accepted what one said. I never remember any great arguments with other members of the DS.
Was there also a naval element?
Yes, we had two naval officers, but there was not a naval instructor.
Was that felt as a lack at all?
I never heard anything mentioned in that line, no.
How did you pass your time when you were at the staff college at Camberley, from a social point of view? Was it a good lifestyle there?
Oh yes, it was extremely pleasant. To begin with, there was games. There was regular cricket, hockey, tennis, and any amount of golf. We were allowed to play on almost any golf course around Camberley from Monday to Friday with a half-crown green fee, which of course was tremendous. And if you wanted to play at the weekend,